Something was written in pen, the blue ink distinct from the black dye pressed through from the other sheets. A name and an age. Allison Siegler, 17 years. Seeing the casual scrawl fired something at Evan's core. He wondered about the 17-year-old girl locked inside container 78653-B812. It seemed that Claude and friends had managed to fulfill one last order this morning before shutting down the assembly belt, which meant that Evan had one last head to sever from the Hydra of Contrell's operation, to put it down for once and for all. He had 16 days until that container ship reached Jacksonville. He would meet the buyer there. But he didn't plan on leaving Allison Siegler alone until then. Folding the yellow form in his hand, he headed out, stepping past the trio of gasoline jugs in the hall and through the front door. Jogging up the front walk, he vaulted the security gate. His boots had just hit the sidewalk when he heard the screech of tires. Two Ford Transits flew in at him, one from either side, a narrowing V. Familiar gray, no side windows. As Evan reached for his hip holster, their doors rolled open, exposing a row of eyes peering out through balaclava masks. Inside each van, a line of shotguns raised in concert, like a gun turret. Neon orange spots floated within the dark vehicle interiors. The shotgun stocks, color-coded for less lethal. Evan had a moment to think, this is gonna hurt. And then the 12 gauges let fly. The first beanbag round hit him square in the thigh, knocking him into a 180, a volley of follow-ups peppering his right side. A rib cracked. Another flexible baton round skimmed the side of his head, a glancing blow, but given the lead shot packed inside, it was enough. No pain, not yet, just pressure and the promise of swelling. He spun with the blow, wheeling to round out the 360, somehow managing to draw his Wilson in the process. The black-clad men had already unasked from the vans in shooting squad formation. These men were expert assaulters, leagues beyond Hector Contrell and his sorry assemblage of freelancers. An enormous man in the middle held a bizarre gun, its conical barrel flaring to accommodate a balloon-like plug. It looked like a basketball stuck in a snake's craw. It discharged with a whoosh. Evan watched it unfurl at him with detached and helpless wonder. Durable nylon mesh, steel clamps weighting the four corners, the whole thing yawning open like the maw of some great beast. A wildlife capture net. It cocooned him, his wrist smashed to his nose, one knee snapped up into his chest, his feet pointed down like an Olympic diver's. This must have been what the Neanderthals felt like when the lava flow caught up, fossilizing them in all their awkward non-glory. His gun hand, pinned to his left ear, was as useless as the rest of him. The pavement smashed his cheek. For a split second, a dot of dancing yellow grabbed his focus, the shipping slip catching a gust of wind, riding an air current into the gutter. The last trace of Allison Siegler whisked away. Evan pegged his pupil to the corner of his eye, straining to look up. A massive dark form loomed, a needle held vertically in latex-gloved hands. The form leaned in, a prick of metal in the side of the neck. Then, searing darkness. 7. The Inevitable Gurgle. Once again, Evan is inside that underground parking lot just south of the Jefferson Monument. Parking level 3 is his personal hell. Or more aptly, his purgatory. It is a humid summer night in 2008, the same night he has been stuck inside for 8 years and change. The elevator sign glows red as always, casting bloody shadows across the slumbering construction equipment. The lot is shut down for improvements. Evan waits behind a concrete pillar, scraping his boots against a bumper curb to dislodge the cherry blossoms from the tread. He has summoned Jack here for a midnight meet. Evan is supposed to be in Frankfurt right now, lying low after a high-profile job in Yemen. But instead, he has flown back to the States, impulsive and agitated, and needing to see the face of the only person in the world he can trust. Evan wants out. Jack raised him to be the finest assassin in the world. He also raised him to keep his humanity. Two trains on a collision course. After a decade spent operating as Orphan X, Evan knows he has to jump off before the crash, even if the jump kills him. He doesn't consider that there might be worse outcomes. Jack didn't want to meet. He said he was watching his movements, that he didn't want to be drawn out, to break cover. But Evan demanded, and despite his better judgment, Jack finally agreed. It happens, as it always does. Jack appears from nowhere, footsteps tick-tocking off the concrete walls, shadows stretched to noirish proportions across the oil-stained floor. He and Evan embrace. It has been more than 2 years since they've seen each other face to face. Jack appraises Evan as if he's a son come home from grad school. A glint of pride touches Jack's eyes. He is baseball catcher square and rarely permits emotion to leak through the mask. The words spill from Evan's mouth. I'm out. Jack answers with the words Evan has heard in 1,000 renditions. You're never out. You know this. Without me, you're just a war criminal. The discussion intensifies, as is ordained. Until the roar of an engine and a startling burst of headlights snap their heads around to the black SUV flying down the ramp, careening onto the deserted parking level. Guns fire through the windshield, muzzle flares strobe lighting the vehicle's advance. Jack grabs Evan, yanks him behind a pillar. Evan rolls across the back of the rounded concrete, the cool surface kissing the blades of his shoulders, and pops out the other side already shooting. He Swiss cheeses the front seats and whoever occupies them. The SUV slows to a crawl, rolls forward to brush Evan's thighs. The would-be assassins, tilted over the dashboard, have been made unrecognizable by his well-placed hollow points. He braces himself for the noise he knows will come next. The inevitable gurgle from behind him. Bright arterial blood soaks the shoulder of the blue flannel. Jack's hand, already wearing a glove of crimson, clamps the wound. Evan rips the flannel off to get a clean look. Needles of blood spray from between Jack's fingers. Lingering beneath the familiar tang of iron, the sickly sweet trace of cherry blossom churns Evan's gut. Years of training have stripped the panic reaction out of him, have crushed it from his cells. And yet, his face hot, time moving differently, grief clawing free of the lockbox in his chest, crowding his throat. Jack is saying things he never said, things he would never say. He is speaking not from the memory, but from Evan's heart of hearts. I took you in, raised you as my own, and you killed me. Why? He raises an arm cloaked in blood, pointing out, away, banishing Evan from the intimate sight of his last ragged breaths, banishing Evan to a lifetime of atonement, banishing Evan from himself. With the bloody flannel mopped around his fist, Evan runs. He runs for the darkness, because only darkness can cover the nakedness of his shame. Only in darkness can he be alone. He came to in silk, liquid sheets caressing his skin, a sea of rumpled purple darker than eggplant, a bed fit for a Maharaja. At first he thought he was still in the dream, and then the pain hit. 8. His own dollhouse. When Evan lifted his head from the pillow, his ribs gave a complaint that set his teeth on edge. He took a moment to remember how to breathe. Then he threw back the silk-soft sheets and sat up with a groan. Facts pinged in at him like June bugs hitting a windshield. He was naked. Wine-red bruises splotched his right side, thigh, stomach, chest. His room was as spacious and luxurious as the sleigh bed unfurled beneath him. Through a groggy haze, he assembled his surroundings in pieces. Vaulted ceiling, exposed beams, insulated curtains on a wrought iron rod, distressed leather chair and ottoman with whip-stitched edges and hammered nail heads, mahogany counter and built-in desk without a chair, crackling logs in a travertine-faced fireplace. The design seemed as un-Los Angeles as one could get. Ralph Lauren sprucing up the Von Trapp family lodge. Evan allowed himself one great big moment of what the fuck. Then he stood, wincing. His head swam from the drugs or too much time spent horizontal, or most likely both. Rustic oak plank floorboards, cool and smooth beneath his soles, brought welcome relief from the toasty hearth. He stretched, taking stock. His hands were fine. Likely a cracked rib. Nothing to do there. The bruising, pyrotechnic but harmless, looked to be at least a few days along. All things considered, the beanbag rounds had lived up to their billing. He crossed to the walk-in closet. Inside hung five button-up shirts, slotted like dominoes, jeans, t-shirts, and sweaters, folded and placed neatly in stacks, took up very little space on the long shelves. No belt. Beside the stacks he found underwear, socks, and two new pairs of high-top hiking boots in 10 and a half. His size. What he'd been wearing prior to his collision with the wildlife capture net was missing. His boxer briefs as long gone as his gun and folding knife. Well then, first things first. He pulled on a pair of jeans, the denim scraping across his bruised thigh. Then he yanked a shirt from the rod, the hanger pulling out of shape. Bizarre. Freeing it, he turned it over in his hands. It was made of pipe cleaner, a pliable chenille stem twisted into the rough shape of a hanger. It took his brain a second to process this oddity. A normal plastic or wooden hanger could be fashioned into a weapon, and they, whoever they were, wanted to make sure he had no weapons. However lovely the decor, Evan was no guest here. His gaze traced the length of the nearest laminate shelf, bolted to the wall. He reached under it, felt the cool of the steel beneath. The hanging rod was welded in place. To get anything loose, he'd need a socket wrench or a plasma torch. Turning his attention to the shirt, he examined the stitching, the collar, the taper from chest to waist. The fabric slid like velvet across his skin. The fit confirmed what he'd suspected. The shirt was custom-tailored, which raised further questions. He'd add them to the list. In the main room he took note of the huge screws securing the leather chair and ottoman to the floor, the curtain rod welded to the wall, the drawerless face of the chairless desk. Crouching by the fireplace, he dipped his head and checked the flue. The metal hatch looked wide enough to accommodate his shoulders, but the robust flames would roast him on the way up. Just for the hell of it, he tried the suite's main door, an oversized block of mahogany that matched the counter and desk. It was locked. Surprise, surprise. But he was impressed by how little it budged in the frame. Next, he trudged over to the bathroom. The door swung open to a new design ecosystem. Asian grays and soothing cobalts, big interlocking bamboo tiles as hard as stone lined the walls. A rain shower head protruded from the wall, unencumbered by a stall. Beneath it, the floor sloped to a drain. Resting beside the drain, a single bar of unwrapped soap and a fluffy bamboo shoot-patterned towel with scalloped edges befitting a fine hotel. No cabinets, no drawers. On the floor next to the lidless and tankless metal toilet, A trash can liner rested in the spot where a bin might go. A wall mirror floated above two sinks, scooped from a single slab of floating granite. Evan drew closer, eyeing not his reflection, but the mirror itself. It was recessed, set behind a plate of armored glass. He took advantage of the mirror to check his bruised ribs more thoroughly. The needle prick at his neck looked to be healed and gone, but a crimson dot in the crook of his elbow showed where a line had been inserted. They'd kept him out all right, feeding who knew what drugs into his system. A prison toothbrush rested between the sinks, pre-pasted, with a stubby handle made of flexible rubber. The mint tasted chalky, but did the trick, scrubbing the medicinal coating from his teeth. He splashed cold water over his face and then leaned against the jamb, regarding the well-appointed bedroom. His own holding pen, in his own dollhouse. It struck him that this was precisely the kind of situation that other people called him for. The inconvenience of this mystery detour made him angry. It was costing him time better spent tracking down Allison Siegler, who was currently trapped inside container 78653-B812, as terrified as it was possible for a 17-year-old girl to be. He strode across the room and threw back the heavy curtains. The sight beyond the balcony made the breath snag in his throat. The view, segmented by welded steel bars at the balustrade, showed mountains blanketed with white pines. It took a moment for the shock to subside. When he twisted the lock and shoved open the sliding glass door, cold air cut straight through his clothes. Rain turned to snow at around 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and the temperature was flirting with that now, the flitting drops hard and angry, hungry for transformation. He wasn't just not in L.A. He was nowhere near L.A. Wherever he was, it was on the floor of a valley. The sun, a blurred splotch of gold, hovered above a ridge to the left. Dusk? Dawn? He stepped out toward the bars that were selling in his balcony, the view yawning wider. Standing here gave him a vantage, however slight, to see part of the massive building in which he was imprisoned. From what he could make out, it looked to be a rambling stone and wood chalet. Above one of the visible A-frames to his right, black smoke poured from a stone chimney. Gauging the distance to the ground and then to the eaves, he guessed he was on the third of four floors. Movement caught his eye below. Two men wearing night vision goggles jogged into view, hunched against the cold, Doberman pinchers at their sides. Evan made a mental note of each man's build, posture, and gait before they disappeared into a bright red barn a quarter mile away from the house. He thought, two dogs, two guards, and counting. The rolling barn door boomed shut, and then the gray diorama beyond the balcony reclaimed the same desolate quality it had before. Evan swept his gaze up the looming rise of the valley, but saw only trees and more trees, not a single other residence in sight. Who wanted him badly enough to stage such an elaborate snatch? Who had the resources, the operational skill? Charles Van Sciver and the remaining orphans, certainly. But this didn't seem to match their modus operandi. Van Sciver would have little interest in keeping Evan comfortable, let alone in luxury. Over the years, Evan had killed a lot of people, disrupting innumerable operations, and left behind countless mourning relatives. Was this the work of a tribal warlord bent on vengeance? A Saudi billionaire with a jihadi son whom Evan had dispatched? Or maybe a foreign agency wanting to come to terms with a lost U.S. asset? Judging by the accommodations, they planned for him to be kept. For what? It dawned on him that he was shivering, so he stepped back inside and secured the door. He gave the walls and ceiling beams a quick scan, deciding where he would place security cameras if the equation were flipped. He walked around so he could watch the light strike the surfaces at different angles. A dot-sized glint caught his eye in a heating vent out of reach on the sloped ceiling. Okay, then. That gave them a view of roughly half the room, including the door leading to the hallway. He searched for where additional pinpoint cameras might fill out the picture. A crack in the doorframe above the bathroom looked promising. If it were up to him, he'd have sunk something in the caulking between the travertine tiles of the hearth as well. He was just starting to consider how the bathroom might be wired when he heard the knock at the door. 9. Our Lady of Holy Death. Standing in the middle of the room, Evan squared to the sound of the knock and braced himself. There came a click as the door unlocked. An honest-to-God room service cart wheeled in. White linen, stainless steel dome plate covers, basket of bread, French press. The only thing that didn't match the Ritz-Carlton presentation was the guy pushing it. Aside from the tattoo high on his neck, a missing incisor, and a general air of menace, he seemed pleasant enough. As the cart rattled into the room, two near-matching gentlemen entered at his heels and fanned out. Each carried an AK-47, a mistake in such tight quarters, though no one had asked Evan's opinion. A pistol or an FN-P90 would have been preferable, but both lacked the big dick factor beloved by narcotraficantes, and these boys seemed to be cartel muscle through and through. Narcos generally called the Kalashnikovs cuernos de chivo, goat's horns, due to the curved magazines. Choosing their spots, they brandished the AKs with a fetishistic air, posing as if Evan were about to snap their portrait. Two dogs, five guards, and counting. The tattoo on the side of each man's neck featured Santa Muerte, a folk saint favored by narcos. Our Lady of Holy Death resembled Mother Mary, if you ignored the grinning skull. Additional ink classing up eyebrows, cheekbones, and forearms indicated that the men had worked for the Sinaloa cartel, responsible for at least half the drugs migrating across the border into the U.S. every year. They'd cleared space at the front door, making way for someone's dramatic entrance. Evan anticipated a cartel leader, strong of jaw and mustache, but the man who appeared defied any expectations. He was Caucasian, with coffee-colored eyes that sloped down at the outer corners, and a face ratcheted taut and shiny from too much plastic surgery. The lid seemed tight across his eyes, as if he were wearing another man's face. Though the surgeries made his age hard to peg, he seemed to be softening into his late 50s, swells bulging the sides of his suit. His tie, vest, and shirt were all patterned, paisleys and plaids orchestrated in a way that eluded Evan's sensibilities, and yet conveyed an undeniable elegance. Somehow they clashed and didn't clash at the same time. At his back hovered a refrigerator of a man, pale as the moon, with a shaved skull and soft, rounded features that made it look as though someone had photoshopped the head of a newborn onto Lou Ferrigno's body. Evan would have expected him to hum with steroidal rage, and yet he seemed calm, almost placid, as if fully aware that his heft gave him the advantage of not having to get worked up over anything. His enormous form tugged at a memory. Was he the one who'd fired the wildlife capture net? Unlike the narcos, he sported no obvious tattoos, though Evan caught flashes of color on the backs of his hands, as if he'd rolled them on a painter's palette. "Your accommodations are good," the man with the suit said, flaring a hand. His fingernails were slightly too long, buffed to a high shine. "I'm a touch OCD, so I wanted everything to be perfect." Evan had long thought that people who announced themselves as OCD should be subjected to death by paper cuts, but this guy, with his elaborate yet understated suit, manicured nails, and done to a turn jail cell come bedroom guest suite, seemed the genuine article. Evan wondered at the kind of money it took to hire muscle away from the cartel. "Where are your manners, Chewie?" the man said. "Prepare the tray for our guest." The narco who'd delivered the cart lifted the stainless steel domes off the plates to reveal eggs, bacon, and hotcakes, then stood at attention with a mix of aggression and embarrassment, like a pit bull made to wear a dog's sweater. The breakfast offerings provided an answer to one of Evan's questions. Moments before, he'd been looking at the sunrise, not the sunset. He moved his gaze past Chewy at the well-dressed man. "Who are you?" he asked. "Renee," the man said. "I know. A faggot name. I can't help but feel that my parents might have gone with something with a bit more spine to it." "Last name?" Evan said. "Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Now, please." As he gestured for Evan to sit, he smiled, though his face did not fully obey. "I'd imagine you're starving. You haven't eaten anything, not from an IV bag, in 3 days." "3 days, then." Evan had been taken on Friday, October 14th, which meant it was Monday, October 17th, which in turn meant that he still had 13 days before Allison Siegler was delivered to the Jacksonville Port Authority and whoever had purchased her. Unless the man was lying about the date. The first commandment: assume nothing. Evan eyed the rifles, then sat on the bed. As Renee stepped forward into the room, his men floated around him in perfect Secret Service diamond formation. The big guy's round face peered over Renee's shoulder like a second head. Through a break in the bodies, Evan could see the wide tips of his fingers on the small of Renee's back, cheated to the side, ready for the hook and grab if Evan made a move. The big man's position and body language made clear that he was the right hand, elevated above the cartel stooges. Renee shot a look back at him. "It's fine, Dex." Dex removed his arm, and Evan strained to catch a glimpse of what was on the back of his hand. But it was gone too fast. Chewy pushed the dining cart forward until it bumped lightly against the ledge of Evan's knees. There was no knife or fork, just a flexible rubber spoon. Scents wafted up. A butter patty dissolved into the hotcake stack. Bacon beckoned. A cloth napkin was cinched into a segment of bamboo stem that acted as a ring, the fine linen bloused out on either side like butterfly wings. There was a fucking sprig of parsley. Evan thought, "You've got to be kidding me." "I suppose you're wondering why you're here," Renee said. "You need me." Renee's moist lips pursed with amusement that wasn't really amusement at all. He didn't like being correctly anticipated. "I'm sorry." "A bullet goes for around 25 cents. These arrangements cost a touch north of that. So you require me for something, or you wouldn't go to the trouble." Renee's stare, lasering out from behind that saran-wrapped skin, was as unnerving as it was direct. "Where am I?" Evan asked. "Think of this as a private sector rendition." "Where am I?" Evan asked again. "That's not relevant." "What's relevant is relative," Evan said.
"Good point. It's not relevant to me for the purposes of this conversation. And what's relevant to me is the only thing that matters anymore."
Renee's hand dipped behind a lapel and came out with Evan's room zone phone. He held it aloft theatrically, then dropped it on the floor and smashed it with the heel of his dress shoe. He stomped on it again until the gorilla glass cracked and the innards showed. Then he picked it up and tossed it into the fireplace. Evan didn't move his head, but watched with his eyes. Renee turned, a bead of perspiration carving its way down his flushed cheek.
"You are in my hands, on my time. There is no help coming for you."
"I don't wait for help. I am the help."
"Well, you're doing a fine job thus far."
"I haven't started yet."
"Let's hope you're smart enough to cooperate. If you do, everything will stay precisely this pleasant."
"Pleasant," Evan said.
"Pleasant is relative as well," Renee said.
"Do
Do you have a name? Did he really not know who Evan was? Or was this an act? Evan watched him closely for any tells. I do. What is it? Evan. Your last name? Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Renee remained several steps back, safely tucked behind Chewie, who was still dumbly holding the stainless steel domes. The cart, pushed up against Evan's legs, had the added advantage of pinning him to the bed. Evan took a croissant from the tray and set it on the bedspread beside him. He removed the napkin from the slender bamboo ring. Dex watched him carefully, flat eyes peering out from their doughy recesses. Renee said, I don't know who you are, but we saw the wreckage you left behind at that house in Fullerton. Were you a client of Hector Contrell's? His tone, Evan noted, held no judgment. No. You had a business conflict with him? Renee asked. No. The steel gaze appraised Evan. You're too skilled to be an angry relative or the like, he said. So what were you there for? Evan stared at him. Realization dawned, excitement asserting itself across Renee's features. You just didn't like him. I respect that. He wet his lips. Who are you? Evan stared at him some more. Renee said, Your driver's license appears to be real, but it's not. No other identification on you. Your fingerprints turned up nothing. Evan rubbed his thumb across his finger pads, only now noticing the faintest trace of blue ink among the whorls. Another violation. We looked at the registration of your forerunner, Renee continued. The vehicle is owned by a Shell Corp in Barbados. We kicked over that rock and found that Shell Corp held by another in Luxembourg. I have a feeling that the more rocks we kick over, the more rocks we're going to find. Evan picked up the bamboo napkin ring, peered through it like it was a telescope. It was about 2 inches long, which was long enough. I think I understand, Renee was saying, this thing you're playing at. He circled a hand at Evan. Evan slipped the bamboo ring over his forefinger and middle finger. The hollow stem fit snugly, locking the knuckles, turning the fingers into a weapon. I'm not playing, Evan said. He leapt to his feet and drove his sheathed fingers through Chewie's eye, straight into his brain. Blood spurted over the white linen. As Chewie tumbled back, quivering in his death throes, Renee recoiled in horror. Two dogs, four guards, and counting. The remaining pair of narcos had their AKs raised, but Evan knew damn well they hadn't gone to all this hassle to gun him down on an overpriced bedspread. Hurling the cart aside, he lunged forward. Dex looped an arm around Renee's midsection, spinning him out into the hall. Before Evan could close the distance, he heard a hissing behind him. He wheeled around, sourcing the noise to the heating vent, only now grasping that it was... 10. The strange language of intimacy. Blood on his neck, swollen cheek, wrists still scraped raw from handcuffs. Evan's small for a 12-year-old, scrawny, and can't remember the last time he had a full belly. He has undergone a daunting set of initiation rites to land here, in this passenger seat of this dark sedan, heading God knows where. He doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know what he will be used for. He doesn't know anything, aside from the name of the man driving. Jack Johns. Maybe this time everything will be different, and... Evan stops the thought. Hope is dangerous. In his brief life, he's done his best to eradicate it. Jack clears his throat. You no longer exist, he tells Evan. You went away for a felony and disappeared into the system. Okay, Evan says. Jack bobs his bulldog head. An hour later, they cross the murky green water of the Potomac and forge west into Arlington, Virginia. The commercial district gives way to tree-lined streets, and then there are more trees and fewer streets. Finally, they turn off between twin stone pillars onto a dirt road and wend their way back to a two-story farmhouse. The silence has grown oppressively thick in the car, and it feels risky to break it. Evan waits until they've pulled into the circular driveway and gotten out by the old-fashioned porch. Then he asks, "Where are we?" And Jack says, "Home." The house smells damp but pleasant, redolent of burned wood. Evan regards the foyer and the family room with suspicion. He doesn't trust the maroon carpet runner up the stairs, the plush brown corduroy couches, the pots hanging from a brass rack in the kitchen. The spectacle of undeniable domesticity leaves him humming with distrust. "Would you like to go upstairs, see your room?" Jack asks.
"No."
"What do you want?"
"I want to know what I'm here for."
"Later." Evan gathers his courage, does his best to summon Van Sciver.
"After everything I did to get here, I think I've earned some respect."
Jack regards him calmly. "If you have to ask for respect, you're not going to get it." Evan does his best to digest this. The words feel less like a slap than a solid wall dropped before him from a lofty height. Jack says, "Someone smarter than either of us once said, if you want equality, act like you already have it." Evan stares at Jack, and Jack stares right back at him. Evan blinks first.
"Okay," he says.
They head up the flight of stairs to a dormer room with a wooden bed. On the mattress, the sheets are folded crisply, ironed into neat squares. Jack's voice floats over his shoulder. "I get paid for this, to have you here. It's a job. The money is not why I took you or want you here. I don't want you to find out later, for it to be a surprise."
"Who's paying you?"
"Later." Jack walks to the desk, lifts the blotter, and uses a fresh handkerchief to wipe away an invisible speck on the polished wood surface. He folds the handkerchief neatly and inserts it back into his rear pocket. "Make your bed." Jack leaves Evan alone in the room. Evan struggles with the sheets. He pulls and tugs but cannot get them on properly, let alone taut and wrinkle-free. He goes downstairs and pokes around until he finds Jack in the garage, meticulously cleaning a handgun. Evan stiffens at the sight of the weapon, then swallows down his fear.
"The sheets aren't right," Evan says.
Jack keeps his gaze on the skinny brush, poking it in and out of the bore. "The sheets aren't the problem. I've used them to make up that bed many times." Evan takes a breath.
"Okay," he says.
"I can't make the bed right." Jack's eyes tick up above the top of the barrel. "And?" It takes a moment for Evan to understand what Jack is waiting for him to say. He finds the words.
"Can you help me?"
Jack lays aside the gun. "Be happy to." Back upstairs, Jack regards the sloppy bed as Evan squirms. Jack walks over, inverts the edge of the fitted sheet over his hand, and shows Evan how to flop it neatly over the corner of the mattress. Jack continues straightening the sheets, keeping his body out of the way so Evan can watch and learn.
"I'll never be able to do it that good," Evan says.
"You don't have to. You just have to make it better than you did last time." Jack snaps the top sheet into place, and it responds like something scared into competence. "Next time. That's all that matters." He finishes and pulls himself upright beside the pristine bed. He passes Evan on his way out. "Would you like to go for a walk?" Outside, Jack gives a whistle, and a moment later a big dog bounds around the corner of the porch and joins them, keeping a few feet off Jack's right thigh. The dog is at least 100 pounds, with a honey-gold coat and what looks like a racing stripe of reversed fur on his spine. Evan says, "Can I pet him?" Strider can be touchy. Let him get used to you. Their shoes crunch pleasingly in the tall grass. They make their way up a slight hill, and the view is all leafy canopy and fields. "What are we doing?" Evan asks.
"Walking. You know what I mean?
We're deciding if we're gonna like each other or not." Evan's training begins the next day, a test of will that puts the previous ones to shame. At knife point in a dark barn, he learns his destiny. His future is illuminated, each revelation like a burst of fireworks. To the world, and even to his own instructors, he will be known only as Orphan X. As his handler, Jack accompanies him to every session. There is breaching and shooting and hand-to-hand, psyops and spycraft and espionage technology. Evan generally returns home exhausted and bloodied. Their days are regimented. In the evenings, they set up in the study, just them and a framed photo of a woman, which rests alone on a side table. She has waist-long hair, a slender neck, and thick-framed eyeglasses from another decade. Evan sneaks glances at her now and then when Jack's not looking. They read a lot, mostly biographies and history books. Evan finds them boring, until Jack talks about them, and then the stories come to life. They listen to classical music records, too. One night, an opera is playing in the background as Evan tries to decipher a chapter about Thomas Jefferson. Jack's voice interrupts the music. "Do you hear that?" When Evan looks up, he sees that Jack's eyes are closed. The opera singer wails ever louder. 9 high C's. When Pavarotti sang this aria at the Met on February 17, 1972, he had 17 curtain calls. 17. Evan does not know what an aria is, or the Met, or a curtain call. So he asks, "Were you there?"
"No."
Evan hesitates.
"Where were you?"
Jack closes the book around his thumb. The textured skin around his eyes shifts a bit as he seems to decide whether or not to answer.
"Laos," he says.
With this response, Evan senses they have broken through onto new terrain. And this is at once exciting and perilous. He ponders a reply, but even rehearsed in his head, the words sound clumsy. He dares to gesture toward the tarnished silver frame.
"How'd she die?"
"Your wife."
Jack says, "An embassy bombing. In Kuwait."
"Was she a spy?"
"She was a secretary."
"Oh." Evan waits until Jack's attention returns to his book. He hesitates, unsure how to proceed in this foreign tongue, this strange language of intimacy. Then he says, "Her eyes are friendly." Jack's gaze stays fixed on the book.
"Thank you, Evan," he says, in a voice even more gravelly than usual.
The alarm goes off early the next morning. Strider is curled on the rug in the dormer room where he now sleeps. Evan scratches behind the dog's ears, then makes the bed. Pausing, he realizes that the sheets are tight enough to bounce a dumbbell on.
"Next time," he thinks, "the two best words in the English language."
When he gets downstairs, he expects to find Jack at the stove, readying the omelet pan. But instead he has his keys in hand and is ready to go. They drive to a Veterans Day parade in town. Evan stands at Jack's side, and they watch the open-topped cars drive by. There are fire engines and fried dough and soldiers with empty sleeves pinned up at the elbows. There are crying moms and old men with watery eyes, their hands over their hearts. There are babies in strollers and young wives with firm tanned skin and lush curls and golden sunlight falling across them, turning the tiny hairs of their arms white. Evan feels an odd sense at his core, a blurring of himself into something greater. All these people joined in common emotion, and the fine, fine flags snap overhead, and he breathes the powdered sugar and the scent of sunscreen, and feels the pulse of all these hearts beating inside his own chest. That night, when he slides into bed and gazes at the slanted ceiling, he feels the pulse still moving through his body, an almost sexual ache in his cells, like the swell of an orchestra on Jack's old record player, the soundtrack of desire, of belonging. He thinks of Jack sleeping downstairs, and how that makes him feel safe. Jack has cracked the world open like a geode, laying its glittering treasures bare. As long as Evan has Jack at his side, he can do anything. A sensation rolls through his body, unfamiliar and warm, and at last he is able to name it. It is the feeling of being given a place in the world. 11. No longer the same place. Evan came to lying flat on his chest, his mouth open against the floorboards. He shoved himself up and leaned back against the sleigh bed, letting the ache between his temples subside. The cart was gone, damp spot on the floorboards where they'd been scrubbed. No sign of Chewie's body. Serious room service. Two fingertips of his left hand were crusted. He went into the bathroom and washed his hands. Then he went to the hearth and pretended to warm himself. His busted Rome zone had fallen through the log grate. Careful to keep his back to the hidden surveillance cameras, he managed to poke beneath the flames to knock the phone into reach. The rubber casing was scorched. Smashed to shit bits of Gorilla Glass turned the screen into a mosaic. Holding the phone low against his belly, he thumbed it on. Miraculously, the lights flickered as it powered up. The Gorilla Glass had protected the phone from the worst of the stomping and the fire, but he could see bits of the circuit board through the cracks. The smart screen seemed unresponsive to touch. There'd be no dialing out. He examined the damage, his excitement quickly fading. He was adroit with electronics, but fixing the phone was beyond his capabilities. When he was 16, he'd been taught by a hacker around the same age who could have figured something like this out in a Red Bull-fueled minute. But that's why she'd been the teacher and he the student. Keeping the phone hidden, he went back to the bed and surreptitiously shoved it between the mattress and box spring. On the unmade sheets, the croissant waited, cold. His stomach announced itself. He took big bites, chewed thoughtfully, his mouth dry from the sleeping gas. In the course of his training, Evan had endured halothane vapor and methoxypropane, but given the roaring fire, he guessed Rene had gone with something less flammable, probably a halogenated ether. He rubbed his eyes, trying to clear his head, then crossed to the window and noted the sun's position high in the sky. He'd been unconscious for a while. Despite the midday blaze, he knew not to be fooled. It was well digger-ass cold out there. Movement caught his eye below. Three men jogging past the barn, disappearing into the tree line. Evan hadn't seen them before. Two dogs, seven guards, and Dex. His thoughts were scrambled, fragments of plans jabbing him from all angles, opposing directives warring in his mind. Well then, as Jack had encoded in the fifth commandment, if you don't know what to do, do nothing. Evan went back to the bed and sat cross-legged on the unmade sheets. Closing his eyes, he took a few deep breaths. He slowed each exhalation, counting to four, letting the alpha brain waves kick in and drop him into a meditative state. After 5 minutes, or 20, he opened his eyes and slid off the mattress. Then he made the bed carefully. He stretched and did push-ups, sit-ups, and a quick core workout, favoring his bruised rib. His muscles felt creaky from the days he'd spent unconscious. He kept all thoughts at bay, focused only on breaking a good sweat. Then he showered and changed and returned to the spot by the window. Standing in the same place with a clearer mind meant it was no longer the same place. He reviewed what little he knew. He now had a grasp on the time. Midday. He'd gleaned the date. October 18th. The next priority was figuring out where he was. His gaze swept the walls low, just above the baseboards. Nothing. He moved to the built-in mahogany desk. The backing floated an inch or so off the wall, no doubt to leave room for appliance plugs. He put one eye to the dark sliver but could make out only darkness. Then he crawled into the space where a chair should be and flattened his cheek to the wall. The power outlet floated a few inches away in the gap between desk and wall. It had only two holes, designed to fit round pins. Clearly not built to receive an American plug. Evan popped to his feet and headed briskly into the bathroom. After scanning the walls, he dropped onto a knee and found a wet room outlet tucked beneath the floating granite slab housing the sinks. This one took a 3-pin plug. 2 round, 1 grounding. That was helpful, too. He searched the bathroom for a hidden surveillance camera, but found none. With the stark stone and tile, there were scant hiding places. He had to assume that the mirror was a one-way and that a pinhole camera was positioned inside the ceiling vent as in the bedroom. But he couldn't be certain. That still left him a blind spot beneath the sink and in the corner by the toilet. He needed to create a blind zone in the bedroom as well. Pausing in the doorway, he searched the crack in the frame, careful not to be obvious. There it was, a pencil eraser-sized circle of metal nestled back in the wood like a dug-in pinworm. He walked over to the hearth and ran his fingertips across the caulking between the travertine tiles, but felt nothing. The vent camera he'd spotted earlier and the bathroom doorframe unit gave them eyes on 3/4 of the bedroom. He looked for a spot that would pick up the remaining quarter. The corner above the closet where the walls met the ceiling. He flicked a gaze quickly in that direction, noting that the point of blackness there was slightly more pronounced than in the other corners. Solid tradecraft. What was the best way to play this? Evan put himself in Renee's shoes and thought for a time before settling on the next step. It was a gamble, but everything was a gamble. Back in the bathroom, he thumbed the remaining paste off the rubber toothbrush where it had been squirted between the bristles. He added a drop of water and worked it between his thumb and forefinger until it gummed up into a gooey mortar. He smeared it over the crack in the frame outside the bathroom. That knocked out their view of half the bed and the sliding glass door. Then he worked up more paste and went to the corner of the room by the closet. Bracing his bare foot against the closet hinges, he put his back to the wall and squirmed his way up off the ground like a rock climber until he could reach the ceiling. He put his face big in the hidden camera, went for a smug smirk. A few swipes, and he'd obscured the tiny lens, eliminating Renee's visuals on the fireplace. He dropped back to the floor and wiped his hands on his jeans, acting satisfied with himself. He'd left them the most essential camera, the one in the heating vent that captured half the room, including the door to the hallway, the one they'd need to discern his position before they entered the room, the one that was filming him right now, acting as though he'd just put one over on them. If Renee was smart, he'd hit Evan with sleeping gas again and reposition the cameras he'd knocked out. But if he was really smart, he'd concede the ostensible defeat, let Evan believe he was surveillance-free in the room, and use the remaining camera to observe what Evan got up to when he thought no one was looking. Head lowered, Evan paced the rustic oak planks, doing his best to construct the chessboard mentally, to anticipate Renee's counter and plan several moves ahead. A knock came at the door once again. He was about to find out how well he was playing the game.
12. Magical Machinations. The entourage entered, Renee flanked by the same narcos, now brandishing familiar, less lethal shotguns. Dex loomed after them, a pipe swinging low behind his leg. With some pleasure, Evan noted that there was a new front man. He looked nervous. 2 dogs, 8 guards, and Dex. Renee said, "Shall we try this again?" Evan looked at him. "No more croissants?" Renee took a few steps toward the bathroom, the men locked in position around him. They moved effortlessly, maintaining a practiced standoff distance. The movement of the air brought a whiff of expensive-smelling cologne. Dex kept a clear route to the door, ready to whisk Renee to safety the instant something went down. Renee regarded the caulked-over crack in the frame above the door. His smile spread his lips flat to the sides, his face slightly off-kilter on his skull. Folding his arms, he drummed his fingers on the fine tweed of his blazer sleeve. "I'll allow you your temper tantrum," he said. "After all, it's not like you're going anywhere." Evan said, "Are we in Switzerland or Liechtenstein?" Renee blinked, and then blinked again. "Why not Romania or Russia?" "The outlets," Evan said. "The C-plug behind the desk puts us in Europe and knocks out the UK. But the J in the bathroom is only used in Switzerland and Liechtenstein." "Well traveled, are you?" Evan stood by the foot of the bed, tense on his feet. "Are we going to keep answering questions with questions?" Renee turned to Dex. "I like him." Evan waited, his gaze steady. The front man grimaced, showing a mouthful of gold-capped teeth, the grill both ridiculous and menacing at the same time. He had lush, curly hair tamped down by a purple Dorados de Chihuahua cap featuring a mustachioed baseball wearing a sombrero. At last, Renee pivoted back to face Evan.
"Graubünden," he conceded. "The easternmost canton of Switzerland."
Evan hadn't been here before, but had stayed in neighboring Ticino. After he escaped, he would get across the border to Liechtenstein. He had a papers guy in Riesenberg who lived in the cellar of an 18th-century parish church. Once Evan was set up with a new passport, he'd hightail it to Vienna, lie low, make his way back to the States. Then he'd intercept the Horizon Express and free Alison Siegler. Renee said, "I hope we can agree that you're helpless here. You're outmanned, outgunned, and overpowered to an extent you're not even aware of yet. Your surrendering to these realities is inevitable." Evan considered. Then he feinted at the group, nothing more than a twitch of his shoulders. The front man jerked away so fast he lost his footing and stumbled. The other two narcos had their shotguns up instantly. Evan said, "Nothing is inevitable." The third shotgun rose, trembling, and for a moment Evan thought the front man might just be nervous enough to pull the trigger accidentally. Renee rested a hand on his shoulder. "Easy, Manny." At this range, aimed at Evan's head, the less lethal shotgun might prove to be not so less lethal. Renee alone remained unshaken. He continued as if there'd been no interruption.
"You're a very difficult man to track."
Evan looked past the 3 shotgun bores at Renee. Dex stared back from the rear, a head taller than the others, his face as expressionless as ever. Just another casual conversation. "Why are you interested in me?" Evan asked.
"I'm not interested in people. I'm interested in bank accounts."
Renee peered out from the stretched mask of his face.
"Your bank account in particular."
"Account. Singular." Evan said nothing. Renee was talking, and there was no advantage in stopping him. "I know that you hold assets worth $27 million in an account in Zurich." Privatbank AG didn't house the lion's share of Evan's money. When Evan was operating as Orphan X, Jack had stocked accounts for him the world over,
and taught him how to hide behind financial veils, how to wire money invisibly from offshore account to offshore account. The cash was printed by the Treasury and shipped directly to areas of non-reporting. It was as untraceable as Evan himself. At least he'd thought it was. Both he and his bank account